This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for a Tuesday afternoon, but no Matt McNeil. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt as he is on vacation for a couple more days. Matt will make his return on Thursday, July 1st. 2 days from now, Matt will be back in studio. So for today, you're stuck with me and Patrick. Then tomorrow, Todd Mickelson back in the hosting seat. Patrick, what's been new with you over there today? I haven't had a chance to really talk to you at all today.
Oh, I got my vehicle tabs renewed. Whoopee. Awesome, exciting news, right?
Oh, that is extremely exciting. Did you do that in person or did you do it online?
I did it online, which was kind of neat because I'd never done that before.
Yeah, I did the same thing, actually, this year with COVID. I just assumed that, well, I can't do it in person. They're probably closed. I had to renew mine back over the winter in February, I think, is when it was. So, yeah, I did mine electronically as well. Although, I know Matt a few weeks ago talked about how there are a few DMV offices that are just notorious for long waits and basically not helping you whatsoever. You can go back and listen to previous podcasts. I don't know the exact date, but the one I've usually gone to is all right. I'm normally a Southdale person when I'm getting mine renewed, and I haven't had any issues. But online, I'll definitely take that rather than waiting in line. So, Patrick, you are legal. Not going to be getting pulled over anymore, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's got to pay off all those tickets.
Pay off all of those tickets. Hey, I do bring up the idea of pulling someone over for expired license tabs. That's going to be a topic a little bit later on in the show when we talk about what's going on in the state legislature. In fact, that's going to be the majority of hour two, is giving you updates on what's happening at the legislature, since they have to come up with a final budget by tomorrow at 11:59 p.m. Otherwise, we get a partial government shutdown, and it looks like things are going to be coming down to the wire, at least on the public safety bill. That is the last major bill where both parties still have some disagreements. Now, the leadership from both the Republicans and the Democrats have largely agreed to a framework on the public safety bill, but there are a number of DFLers on the House side, especially from the People of Color Caucus, that don't think there are enough public safety measures that help citizens from police brutality and other things like that. So they are expected to load up the public safety bill today with a whole bunch of amendments, which could drag out the proceedings quite a bit longer and, in essence, lead us to having a different House bill than Senate bill when it comes to public safety, which means probably tomorrow we're going to have more negotiations between Republicans and Democrats on that final public safety bill once they eventually do come to, or once the bill does get through the House, because what's probably going to happen is that, yeah, the DFLers will attach a bunch of amendments to the bill, but Republicans will strip it out. So we'll have a lot more on that coming up in hour number two, including a breakdown on some of the demands that some of the DFLers would like in that public safety bill and what can be done, especially through executive action with Governor Wahl. So if you're in for following along with what's happening at the state capitol and the state legislature, hour two is going to be for you, as we'll spend the bulk of the time doing that. We'll also be joined by Patrick Coulican of the Minnesota Reformer during hour two with more updates from the state legislature. But here in hour one, we're going to start off a little bit on the lighter side. And Patrick, I feel really bad for Matt McNeil today, being that he is not here hosting the show, because this story is right in his wheelhouse, absolutely in his wheelhouse. We have tragedy in the city of Edina, absolute tragedy in Edina. The Edina Hornets are no more. They will no longer exist, at least in the current form. Edina Public Schools' green and yellow Hornet logo will not be landing on sports uniforms, school buildings, or anywhere else in the near future, or possibly ever again. Patrick, you can grab some tissues in there if you need it, but we might not be seeing that Edina Hornets logo anymore. A long-running copyright dispute over the recognizable image went public this month when Edina announced it would pause the use of the logo after receiving a cease and desist letter from the man who designed the Hornet logo 4 decades ago. If you didn't know that, the current Edina Hornets logo, which you might recognize as being that green and yellow Hornet. I'm not good. I'm not like Vin Scully when it comes to describing what the logos look like. Fill me in if you got a better way to describe it. But anyone's probably seen that famous Edina Hornets logo. It was designed by an Edina graduate back in 1981 when he was a student at the high school, and he wisely copyrighted the logo. So he does own the rights to this thing. So that's where this whole dispute arises from now. When I originally saw the headline, Patrick, when I saw Edina forced to change their logo, I thought, uh-oh, is this going to be like one of those cases where we found something offensive somehow in the Hornets' name? I was sitting there thinking, I can't think of anything that would be in the Hornets' name that would be offensive. But that was my first thought. And I was thinking, oh, man, if that's the case, you just know how much that story is going to blow up in Edina with accusations that Edina's going woke. They won't even let us use the Hornets logo anymore. But fortunately, it is just over a copyright dispute. But Edina being Edina, there's always all sorts of drama when it comes to the Hornets. Not the first time they've been in trouble with their logo. You might remember this back in 2012 when the Edina girls dance team. I'm talking about this because this is so amusing, and this story is possibly even dumber than the one I'm going to bring up right now. So back in 2012, the Edina girls dance team, at the time known as the Hornets, not the Hornets, were forced to change their name to the standard school name, Hornets. That led to an uproar among parents of the Edina girls dance team and members of the community saying they should be able to keep their name Hornets. They had a number of packed school board meetings just over the name of a stupid mascot of a dance team. So that gives you some context as to how seriously the Edina Hornets logo and name is taken in the city of Edina. So continuing, this is from the Star Tribune talking about this copyright dispute between this guy who designed the Hornets logo and Edina High School. Whether the district resumes use of the logo or replaces it with something new depends on if it can resolve its differences with Michael Otto, an Edina graduate who created the Hornet image and had it copyrighted, very wisely so, after he won a school district logo contest in 1981. Otto now lives in Grove City, Minnesota, and works as a community chaplain and professional Santa. How is someone a professional Santa? I just love that the Edina Hornets logo is held up by a guy who is classified as a professional Santa.
What do you even put on your 1040 for doing that?
That seems like, yeah, that's a good point. That would be an invitation to be audited if I worked for the IRS. If I saw some guy that put in his tax return that he's a professional Santa, yeah, I might be auditing him. Good point over there. But I love the fact that the use of the Edina logo and name is essentially being held hostage by a guy who's a professional Santa. Oh, if only Matt McNeil were here today to do that voice and the outrage that I'm sure is going over the city of Edina right now. I guess the Hornets might be getting cold this year from our professional Santa who owns the copyrights to their logo. This is the quote from Otto, again, the guy who owns the copyrights. He says, I got to design my high school's logo. Why would I ever want to charge a dime? I want the legacy of it standing the test of time. I want it to be the logo forever. So he's basically saying that he doesn't want to get paid for the logo. He just wants to make sure it's being used for the community and being used for the school. Otto said the issue is whether the district needs to respect his copyright and respect the agreement that gives him the right to decide anytime Edina wants to embroider their Hornet logo on a hockey uniform, stamp it on a bell of a marching band tuba, or paint it on the school floor. He said the arrangement has gone swimmingly until recent years, when Edina school officials decided to take the logo to an out-of-state company that sells school logo clothing and other products and refused to give Otto an accounting of how much money is made or where the logo might end up. So, I'm sorry, you can already tell that this Otto guy is a real pain in the you-know-what, so I don't think there's necessarily any good guys in this story, but I'm just amused by it. In a statement published on its website, the school district said it was seeking a more permissive agreement with Otto because people in Edina want to be able to use the Hornet image more frequently. That might answer a question, Patrick, when I've been out covering and been contracted to stream like different youth hockey events, why the Edina youth hockey teams never have the Hornet logo on their uniforms. I was always curious about that because I've heard of other youth sports teams that go by their high school mascot, but not in Edina. So I found that part kind of interesting. Let's see, where was I? It says, attempts to broker such a deal have been met with such resistance from Otto that the district has enlisted a graphic design firm to come up with a new Hornet logo. And I'm sorry, that's what Edina should have been doing from the beginning. If you're sitting there and realize you have a marketable school logo and the copyright isn't owned by your own school, you should probably consider changing it, because this is the exact situation you're in right now, where your use of the logo is largely at the discretion of the professional Santa, a.k.a. Michael Otto, who now lives in Grove City, Minnesota. So that's on Edina right there. The second they figured out, and they probably should have, being the city of Edina, and that it is the one of the more prestigious athletic schools in the state of Minnesota, that they probably should have designed their own logo and got that copyrighted. This is a quote from Troy Stein, the principal – or not at the principal, the athletic director at Edina, as he says, this is obviously not our first choice of direction as we value our logo and our emotional ties to it. Stein's statements also noted the district has had to turn down many requests for using the logo because of the restrictive terms of the deal it made with Otto back in 1981. So apparently this guy is going through and approving everything that Edina is using with the logo. District officials were not available to comment further on Monday, but spokesperson Mary White said the district is careful to make sure the Hornet image is only used in a way that properly represents the school and its students and employees. Otto disputes... Or excuse me, let's go back here. This is another quote from the district spokesperson, Mary White, who says, however, we need the ability to select our vendors, and according to product, budget, and time constraints, it has become increasingly difficult to work within the restriction of this agreement. Otto disputes the characterization, saying he's been happy to sign off on all sorts of requests, and he has largely backed most of the plans of the district to use their logo on school jackets or school uniform, so on and so on. Occasionally, he's asked to receive one or two copies of whatever is made, but Otto said otherwise has not profit. He has otherwise not profited from the logo. He said he cares deeply about Edina schools and wants the logo to stick around, but needs the district to hold up its end of the deal. He says Edina High School is not above the law. You can't just say because you're Edina, you can do whatever you want when you want, and I should just roll over. The district said it will seek input from the community on a new Hornet design if it comes to that. So, boils down to the fact that, yeah, this guy has the copyright, and as much of a pain as he is to work with, sorry, Edina, that's the guy you got into bed with back in 1981, and the second you realized that your logo could probably be sold for a profit, probably should have designed that and copyrighted that yourself. So, I got a kick of that, and I'm just sad that Matt McNeil here is not here today to comment on that and to do his Edina voice about, I'm sure, the outrage that's happening along the Highway 62, 169, 100 corridor right now. It is an absolutely sad day in the city of Edina. Patrick Lilly, I know you're really choked up in there.
I know, right? And as you said, Edina guy unfortunately could not be reached for comment either on this matter.
Oh, you're not going to give us the Edina guy impression. You were doing it before we jumped on air. You had a decent one going, not quite up to the Matt McNeil standards on your Edina guy voice.
How much does Mr. Otto want for this? $1 million, $2 million, $10
million? There you go. Yeah, we got to get that voice in there, the Edina guy voice. We'll see what happens. We'll be following this closely, or not so closely, here at AM 950. I don't think I'll ever be talking about this story again, but I just find it amusing, being that Matt always loves talking Edina, and whenever there's a tragedy in Edina like this, it draws my attention too. I didn't look on the Star Tribune, though, and I should have before I come on the show to see if this is like under their top five most read stories. Typically, you can find that on the Strib website where they list their five most read stories, and usually it's hard-hitting news stuff, but occasionally they'll put in some goofy stuff like this. And I'll have to check and see if the Edina Hornets logo saga made its way to the top of that Star Tribune list. All right, got some other news to pass along to you for today, at least on the sort of sports and maybe intersection with politics line of news today. TCF Bank Stadium, speaking of names, is going to be no more. TCF Bank Stadium will now be known as Huntington Bank Stadium, as that was recently approved today by the U of M Board of Regents. Huntington Bank Stadium just doesn't seem to quite work. I mean, Huntington sounds like something that's out on like the beach in California, and we're quite the opposite of that being here in Minnesota, so I don't really know if that name fits, but I don't know. It's still a college stadium. I think you should be naming that after an actual person. Like, I don't know, I think Bronco Nagurski was one of the best Gopher football players of all time. Name the stadium after him. Professional stadiums, yeah, go ahead. Sell your naming rights. I don't know. I'm not so comfortable about doing that with a college campus and college stadiums when you have a lot of this being subsidized, obviously, by taxpayer dollars and the fact that it is a public institution being the University of Minnesota. What do you think? Huntington Bank Stadium. I don't like the name of it, but I guess that's who their corporate sponsor is. You have any thoughts on this new name for the Gopher Stadium, Patrick?
It kind of felt like they took something that didn't work, and now it's just going to become another thing that didn't really work. Mm-hmm. And it kind of, if you think back to the original Gopher Stadium that was there before they played in the Metrodome, that was called Memorial Stadium, which, you know, there's a lot of history behind that name. And so then they come back on campus, you know, 37 years later, or 27, something like that. I'm not very good at math. But then they come back to campus, and you're going to play in something called TCF Bank Stadium, and you just kind of go, okay.
And if I'm not mistaken, isn't the guy who owned TCF or was the CEO of TCF Bank, didn't he end up moving to South Dakota because he didn't like the tax structure of Minnesota? If I'm remembering correctly, yeah, it doesn't ring a bell for you. I could be wrong on that. I'll look it up during the break. But, yeah, that didn't really help when it came to naming the stadium TCF Bank Stadium. And it doesn't even have a cool ring to it, like Camp Randall with Wisconsin, or the Big House in Michigan, or the Horseshoe in Ohio. Instead, we get the Bank. That doesn't even sound like a very intimidating stadium. So TCF Bank Stadium, no more, now going to be known as Huntington Bank Stadium. A little bit more on the hard-hitting news front with the University of Minnesota. Their Board of Regents, besides renaming the football stadium, has signed off on a 1.5% tuition increase. That is despite the objections of students who felt a price hike was unwarranted after a year of mostly online learning. And I would largely be with the students on that one, being that, of course, yeah, there was mostly distance learning last year, and we are still in the midst of a recession. Working our way out of it. Yeah, 1.5% tuition increase is not going to help many students, so don't blame them in that regard. And final sports story for you, the Minnesota Wild are going to be hosting the Winter Classic after all next year. We were supposed to host it at Target Field on January 1st of this year, but obviously that was canceled due to COVID. Instead, the Winter Classic is going to be New Year's Day 2022 at Target Field. Patrick, fill me in on this. Why did they choose Target Field and not, well, I guess now, Huntington Bank Stadium? That would seem to me be the better stadium for sight lines for hockey. Do you have any insight on that as to why they chose Target Field?
I actually do not, but okay. There just kind of seems to be this thing about playing non-baseball sports in baseball stadiums, and people think it's awesome.
I don't. Yeah, you're right. We've seen bowl games being played at Wrigley Field and Yankee Stadium. Yeah. Stop playing other sports at baseball stadiums. There are reasons why baseball stadiums are designed for baseball. All right, coming up next, we are going to switch gears and talk some national politics, because I want to completely go through what exactly is happening with the Arizona audit. Oftentimes, we hear bits and pieces of the problems that are coming from Arizona with the audit that they're putting on, but I want to actually walk you through the entire process of how we got to where we are now and how it could apply to a state like Minnesota and others in the future. So stick with us. We'll be talking about the Arizona audit up next on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. We're back on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Todd Mickelson filling in for Matt tomorrow. Then Mr. McNeil makes his triumphant return on Thursday for a couple of shows before we head into the 4th of July. But until then, you're stuck with Patrick, you're stuck with me, and you're stuck with Todd here for at least the middle part of the week. All right. So before we head to break, I was talking about how in this segment we're going to be focusing on what's happening in Arizona with their audit of the presidential election, at least in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix and several of its suburbs. And the reason why I want to talk about this is that what's happening in Arizona sort of reminds me of what happened back during the George W. Bush days and even to an extent the Trump days, where it felt like we had so many scandals coming out of the Bush administration, it was tough to keep track of. And it was tough to keep them in context just because we had so many of them that it was tough to put everything together and just realize how ridiculous everything was back with the Bush administration and also the Trump administration. And I think this same sort of thing is happening with this presidential election audit in Arizona, where we have just so many wacky things coming out of Arizona that it sometimes is hard to put everything together and put everything into context as to just how bonkers what's happening in Arizona is right now. So I wanted to walk you through the entire process of how we got to the point of where we are right now and how it could really affect things in other states, including Minnesota. So let's back up for a second. If you remember back in November of 2020, obviously we had a presidential election which was won by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, thanks in large part to a victory in the state of Arizona where Joe Biden won the state by, I believe, less than half a percentage point. Now, that was, of course, a close election, and when you have close elections, yes, they should be audited. And Arizona did perform their own audit after the November 2020 election, but it was not good enough for Republicans in that state. In the Arizona State Senate, which is currently controlled by Republicans, they wanted to conduct their own audit. So on March 31st of 2021, the Arizona Senate Republican Caucus hired four firms to examine the ballots in Maricopa County in the races for the U.S. Senate and the presidential election. Now, before they could even hire some of these firms, the first one they wanted to go with had direct ties to the Donald Trump campaign. So the Arizona Senate Republicans immediately had to drop those guys. Instead, among the four firms, the lead firm they hired was this group called Cyber Ninjas, who you've probably heard of in the news. They're the lead firm, and Cyber Ninjas is owned by a guy named Doug Logan, who is a Trump supporter and proponent of Donald Trump's claim that there was voter fraud. Logan also appeared in a conspiracy theorist film riddled with falsehoods about the 2020 election, and was directed by a man whose previous work claimed aliens were behind 9/11. So just think about that again. The guy who is the head of the lead firm of the Arizona audit appeared in a film directed by a guy who believes aliens were behind 9/11, and this film that Logan appeared in basically spread all sorts of falsehoods about the 2020 election. And like I said, this was after the Arizona GOP tried to hire another firm with even more direct ties to Donald Trump. So again, there's four firms that are involved in the Arizona recount. Primarily the one, the lead firm, is Cyber Ninjas. The hand recount is managed by Wake Technology Services, which reportedly had been hired for a previous audit in a rural Pennsylvania county by Trump attorney Sidney Powell, who, if you don't remember, Sidney Powell is a Trump attorney who promoted numerous conspiracy theories about the election. In fact, her conspiracy theories were so ridiculous that when Sidney Powell was sued by Dominion, the manufacturer of election machines, Powell's lawyer said a reasonable person would not buy her claims. And she was the person who was responsible for bringing this other company, Wake Technology Services, on board to manage the hand recount. And by the way, Wake Technology Services primarily works in the healthcare sector with little to no experience in elections. So you can already see how much of a clown show this is already. Now, the process of the audit involves a search for evidence of fraud and a hand recount of the 2.1 million ballots cast in Arizona's largest county, Maricopa County, which includes the city of Phoenix. As part of the audit, auditors have been looking for secret watermarks, machine markings, and bamboo fibers within the ballots. The testing for bamboo fibers, by the way, was intended to prove a conspiracy theory that counterfeit ballots were being shipped from South Korea and China to be counted in the election. Arizona Republicans funded the effort with $150,000 from the state Senate operating budget, but as we'll talk about, it's going to end up costing the state a whole lot more than that $150,000. The Arizona Republic reported in May, that's a newspaper in Arizona, they reported in May that because Senate Republicans had given private companies and individuals unfettered and unmonitored access to voting machines, the county might need to expend significant funds and time to ensure the equipment would meet federal, state, and local requirements for certifying and protecting election equipment. The Republic reported voting machines were worth about $6 million, and it sounds like Arizona is already going to have to replace those voting machines because these auditors that are doing the Arizona audit didn't take proper precautions to make sure that these machines weren't given unmonitored and unfettered access like they are right now. Continuing on May 5th, the U.S. Department of Justice sent Karen Fawn, who is the president and leader of the Arizona Senate Republicans, a letter expressing concern that the audit may violate federal laws. One concern is that the law requires election officials to maintain contested custody of all voting records for up to 22 months. Another concern is that the statement of work for Cyber Ninjas authorizes Cyber Ninjas to knock on voters' doors to ask them if they voted in the 2020 elections, which may amount to voter intimidation and constitute a violation of the Voting Rights Acts of 1965. Yeah, you can't just go knock on someone's door and ask if they voted as part of an audit. After the Department of Justice threatened to sue over this plan, Cyber Ninjas at least backed down from the idea of knocking on people's doors asking them if they voted. On January 2nd, Arizona Secretary of State Katie Hobbs issued a report detailing observations made to that point by election observers from her office alleging various infractions on the part of auditors. These included leaving security gates open, leaving confidential materials unattended, and bringing prohibited items, including cell phones and pens with black or blue ink, to the counting floor. In particular, black and blue ink pens are prohibited for obvious reason because those are typically the colored pens you would use to fill in those ovals when you're doing your ballot. So, again, just to put this in perspective, and we'll continue with this on the other side of the break, the Arizona Senate Republicans originally wanted to hire a firm that had direct ties to Donald Trump. And when they couldn't do that, they hired Cyber Ninjas, who is basically owned by just one guy. In fact, when media organizations have tried calling Cyber Ninjas, every single department seems to go to this one guy, Doug Logan, who is a Trump supporter and proponent of conspiracy theories and, like I said, appeared in a film directed by a guy who believes that aliens were behind 9/11. That's who's behind the audit. And as we talked about, this whole audit is going to cost a lot of money since the voting machines are going to have to be replaced because in Arizona they decided, or these auditors decided, not to follow proper procedures of making sure that there was confidential data not being released and to make sure that machines weren't being left unattended. Overall, an entire mess. But there's one thing I want to bring up on the other side of the break that I think could be in a really effective campaign tactic for Democrats for campaigning in 2022. We'll talk about that on the other side of the break and how what's happening in Arizona could have some ramifications for Minnesota and other states around the country. So stick with us. You're listening to the Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson guest hosting for Matt on a Tuesday afternoon. We'll have more on the way next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday afternoon. Matt is back on Thursday hosting some live shows. So until then, you got me today, then Todd Mickelson on Wednesday. So before the break, we were talking about, and trying to go through what's happening in Arizona and all of the problems with the presidential election audit of Arizona right now. And we were talking about how originally the Arizona Senate, and again, this took place all after the state had already conducted their own efforts. The Arizona Senate wanted to conduct their own audit. Arizona Senate controlled by Republicans. They've hired a couple of firms with very close ties to Donald Trump, including Cyber Ninjas, which is owned by a guy who is a prominent Trump supporter and peddler of conspiracy theories. They have basically, during the audit, not taken any proper security measures, which means there have been unfettered access to voting machines, which will now need to be replaced, and that will cost the state millions of dollars. And overall, they're just making very, very basic errors, including this from Karen Fahn, again, leader of the Arizona Senate Republicans. She made an allegation, later amplified by Donald Trump in a May 15th post on his blog, asserting that Maricopa County election officials deleted the voting database after the election. Very serious charge if you're saying that the county deleted all of their election data, except that didn't happen. Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer, who is a Republican who oversees elections, tweeted that Trump was unhinged, noting that he was looking at the database on his computer at that very moment. Richer added, "We can't indulge in these insane lies any longer." The auditors later acknowledged that they had been examining hard drives the wrong way and the database had not been deleted, though the CEO of Cyber Ninjas, subcontractor Ben Cotton, later said they were able to recover all the deleted files. No, you weren't able to recover the deleted files. As we just mentioned a moment ago, they were just looking at the database wrong. Just shows how completely incompetent that these guys are. Now, this is perhaps the most egregious error that happened. It was reported this month that a Cyber Ninjas subcontractor had transported copies of voting systems data to a supposed lab in Big Fork, Montana, of all places. The exact nature of the data and what efforts had been taken to keep it secure was unclear. A CNN reporter traveled to the location listed in property records for Cyber Ninjas in Montana and found a cabin in a wooded, non-commercial area with a no trespassing sign. So that's where all sorts of election data and very well personal voter data is being kept, at some guy's cabin in Big Fork, Montana, that he drove there from Arizona. How would that not raise just a ton of red flags? Your personal data was transported in some guy's truck to some lab in Montana for a forensic audit or something like that. And to me, that is your most powerful argument, I think, if you're Democrats in Arizona or any state of the country. Data privacy and what's happening with your personal data with these auditors. I would be very concerned if I were a resident in Arizona and my personal data was potentially compromised by some idiot who drove it in a truck to a random cabin in Montana for some sort of forensic audit. To me, that's a pretty powerful campaign argument to make if you're Democrats in Arizona saying, look, Republicans don't care about your data. Your data could very well be sold to the highest bidder thanks to this stupid audit that was conducted. And by the way, when you voted, you didn't sign any consent form saying that you consented to having your data sold potentially. Now, I know that hasn't been reported yet that the data has been sold, but we don't know. Cyber Ninjas hasn't told us what's been happening with this data at this Montana cabin. The Arizona Senate Republicans haven't told us what's happening, so if I'm a Democrat, that's the argument I would be making in that state, is that, look, Republicans are potentially exposing your personal information. Are you comfortable with the fact that some guy who, again, appeared in a film that was directed by a guy who said aliens were behind 9/11 has access to your personal data and your personal information? That, to me, would make angry a lot of people, including me, if I knew some random political operative had access to my political data. What are you thinking about that, Patrick? To me, that would make me livid if that happened in Minnesota.
It didn't sound like they really thought this through very well, for one thing. It's like, if you want to try to make it look like you're doing something, you have to make it look convincing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, with the They took it up to the lab, which is really just you know, some guy working by himself in the backwoods. Like when you hear that, that just makes this all sound like a big joke. That your state just gave a bunch of money. I don't know if it was the state or if this was the Trump campaign or both, who gave money, real money that may have come from taxpayer money, to this guy in a cabin. Who you said was hauling, I don't know, did he just like rent a Penske truck from Phoenix? You know,
we don't know. Yeah, they won't tell us anything.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, maybe he just put all this stuff in, you know, a rent a truck that you get for, you know, 20 cents a mile and drove it up to his cabin. This sounds like a joke. Why would you ever consent to doing that if you want to make this look real?
Yeah, you have some random guy, who knows, driving a U-Haul to Montana, potentially with your personal data. So I know when it comes to campaigning on this issue, you can point out all of the other errors that these auditors have made and all of the other ridiculous things that they've done. But I think this is the most egregious one, that potentially your personal data has been compromised thanks to Arizona Republicans. And I hope they do capitalize on this, because there was this poll just released today from Ben Dixon and Amati, which showed by a 49-46 margin, Arizona voters are opposed to the audit. That margin should be a lot bigger than that. Only 49-46. That's why I think you need to focus on this idea of having your personal data secured and making sure it's not being sold to the highest bidder, which very well could be happening in Arizona. I don't know if that's happening for a fact, but I'm just asking questions to quote what a lot of right-wingers say. And we haven't heard any word on what's been happening with all of this voter and personal data that is at some cabin in a woods in Montana. Now, here's how this could apply to a state like Minnesota. Rewind back to 2016 and the Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump election. Hillary Clinton only won Minnesota by about 44,000 votes, or 1.5 percentage points. Now, let's just say we lived in an alternate reality in 2016 where the Minnesota results held. But let's say a few thousand more voters had decided to go for Hillary Clinton in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. All of a sudden, Minnesota would be in the crosshairs for a potential stop the steal of 2016. And just think of who is currently sitting in the state legislature right now, because this is all happening in Arizona thanks to their state senate and their state senate leader, Karen Hahn. This is all from the state legislature. It has nothing to do with national politics or what's going on in Congress. And just think for a moment of who's in the Minnesota state legislature. Kurt Daut is the Republican leader of the House. Paul Gazelka, the Republican leader of the Senate. If we're to get a close election in Minnesota again, a close presidential election, or heck, maybe even a close Senate election, and Republicans are in control of the state legislature, I don't know. I think Gazelka might push back a little bit on having some sort of Arizona-style audit, but Kurt Daut, I don't doubt for a second, pun intended very much there, that he would be behind this sort of forensic audit that's happening in Arizona. Kurt Daut, I think, would absolutely be on board, especially when you consider that he would be pressured by the likes of Eric Mortensen and others. So even though this wackiness is happening in the southwest United States, thousands of miles from us, it very easily could come to a state like Minnesota if you put Republicans in charge of the state legislature and then we have a close presidential election. I could totally see them saying, you know what, we need to audit those results from Hennepin County and from Ramsey County because we think there was voter fraud. And would you really want someone like Eric Mortensen or Kurt Daut hiring their own audit firms and then potentially exposing your personal data to private contractors that have no experience doing election data? Yeah, that very easily could happen in Minnesota, being that we have had close presidential contests in the past. So even though this is still taking place miles and miles from us, it very easily could come to Minnesota in the future. And that's an argument Dems should be making right now. If you vote and elect GOP members to the state legislature, there's a good chance they're going to sell your personal data to random people who have no experience with auditing elections and are largely political operatives that believe in conspiracy theories. Are you good with that? Are you good with your personal data being stored at some guy's cabin in Montana, of all places? Because that potentially is what could happen if you elect Republicans at the state legislative level. Like I said, it hasn't happened in Minnesota, but I guarantee you if we were to have a close presidential election or U.S. Senate election and a legislature controlled by Republicans, I very easily could see them pulling the same sort of shenanigans in Minnesota that they're doing in Arizona.
I mean, they tried and Biden won the state by 8 percentage points. They were like, oh, there were irregularities. State Republicans were, you know, they tried to do what they could. They were like, we should join the lawsuit against the election, which obviously they couldn't because they didn't have control of anything, but they still tried what they could.
Yeah, and that was the fringe part of the party still trying to make that move. And I think the only reason why the more, I won't even call them moderates, I'll call them the more establishment part of the Republican Party, didn't get on board with that is because, as you said, Joe Biden won the state by about 8 percentage points, which would make any sort of audit laughable. But let's say that election had been decided by only 2 or 3 percentage points. I would think you would have more and more so-called establishment Republicans on board with some sort of audit of Minnesota's elections, especially as they were would probably get pressured by the likes of Eric Mortensen, who is just the crazy Republican representative from Shakopee. I won't even go back and talk about his backstory except to say that he was basically kicked out of the Republican Party because he was even too extreme for them. That's a guy who would probably be pressuring someone like a Kurt Dowd or a Paul Gazelka to have an election audit in Minnesota, among others. So keep that in mind, even though it's happening in Arizona, easily could come to Minnesota if we had a close presidential election like we had in 2016, where Hillary only defeated Trump by about 44,000 votes. So make that argument. Data privacy. Republicans, if you elect them at the state legislative level, good chance they're not going to protect your data privacy. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's go to Gary in Minneapolis before our final break. Hey, Gary, how you doing today?
You know, I've noticed Republicans lately, they're saying one thing and then doing another thing, you know. They love the Second Amendment. There's nothing they love better than the Second Amendment, except for probably money. They love money, grabbing it from the rest of us. And that was a battle cry. The one taking my gun away. And then Gazelka, I don't know what happened to him. He's saying the cops have confiscated 700 or more guns on those petty driving stops, you know, driving stops. So I think it's a bunch of racial rhetoric, really. So.
Yeah, that's definitely a part of it too, Gary, and appreciate the phone call as always. Let's take one final break and come on back to wrap up hour one of the Matt McNeil Show. Brett Johnson filling in here on a Tuesday afternoon. Well, as long as we're on the topic of Arizona, I got to bring you this in from the national news. Washington Post reports Representative Paul Gosar, Republican U.S. rep from Arizona and another proponent of the audit. Now, keep in mind, he's at the U.S. congressional level. He's not at the state legislature. Anyways, Gosar is hosting a fundraiser with America First PAC, a group run by young far-right operative Nick Fuentes, who has promoted white nationalist ideas and whom the Department of Justice has labeled a white supremacist. Fuentes, in his past, has defended segregation and bemoaned the United States losing its white demographic core. He has cast doubt on millions of deaths in the Holocaust and engaged in a lengthy metaphor likening the deaths to cookies baking in an oven. He labeled the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol awesome and a racist rally in Charlottesville that resulted in the death of a counter-protester incredible. That is just the madness we're seeing from the Republican Party in the Southwest, and it's creeping its way into Minnesota, too, with some of our elected officials. All right, hour two, stick around. We're going to be talking about the state legislature, also joined by Patrick Coulican, so stick around. Well, not this section, at least. We'll be live until about 5:40 or so, and we'll be joined by Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer, talking about the latest political news, including state legislature trying to finalize those budget agreements. We'll also talk about voter ID and why some Democrats around the country have embraced the idea now of having a voter identification system. So that'll be Patrick Houlihan. We'll be speaking with him around 5:35 or 5:40. But until then, you are live with Patrick and me, Brett Johnson, filling in for Matt McNeil on a Tuesday. Matt is back on Thursday, so until then, you got me today, and then we got Todd Mickelson filling in on Wednesday. All right, Patrick, so the Minnesota State Fair is back, of course, after a one-year hiatus due to the pandemic. And by the way, I didn't know this. This was not the first time the Minnesota State Fair has been canceled due to a public health crisis. State Fair was also canceled in 1946. If anything, I thought the State Fair would have been canceled like maybe during World War II just because of everything that was obviously going on with that. But State Fair was last canceled in 1946 due to an outbreak of polio. So there you go. Not the first time we've canceled it due to a public health emergency. But anyways, the State Fair has released 27 new foods and 4 new food vendors for the 2021 Great Minnesota Get-Together. So I won't read you all 27 foods. I'm just going to go through a few of these that caught my attention. And donuts and biscuits certainly seem to be a theme this year, including the Buffalo Chicken Doskit. It's a fluffy biscuit-style donut stuffed with shredded chicken, glazed with a sweet and spicy buffalo icing, and topped with crispy bacon bits. You can find that at the Blue Barn, located at the West End Market, south of History and Heritage Center. Is that a win in your book, or is that that kind of a so-so? For me, that's kind of a so-so. I don't know. What about you?
Yeah, that's kind of a so-so for me as well. What I'm kind of – what is a doskit? I'm trying to – it's a D-O-U-G-H-S-C-U-I-T.
I think I'm saying it right. Yeah, they must be combining a donut and a biscuit with that.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that's what they're doing. And yeah, fluffy biscuit-style donuts stuffed with shredded chicken. Who wants chicken with donuts? That's my problem right there. Whenever I'm eating a donut, I don't sit there and think, boy, I really wish I could have some chicken with this donut. And that's kind of a theme with all of the state fair food, is that you get these odd combinations of food, including what's another good one we got here? How about the waffle burger? That is a quarter-pound bacon cheeseburger served between 2 maple-infused candy sweet crunch waffles with a side of maple syrup and hopefully a defibrillator as well. It is at Andy's Grill, located on the south side of Carnes Avenue between Chambers and Nelson Street. A waffle burger. I mean, again, it's a weird combination of food. If I'm eating a burger, I don't sit there and think, boy, I really wish I could have some maple syrup with this as well. At least when I grew up, I always loved eating breakfast for dinner. That was always kind of fun to do. My dad didn't like that at all, but the rest of my family did. But I've never actually wanted to combine breakfast and dinner foods. I am all for eating breakfast at dinner and eating dinner at breakfast, but combining the foods, no. I don't know about this idea of combining a waffle and a cheeseburger. Ew, that's just kind of nasty to think a burger combined with any sort of maple syrup.
Yeah, because I'm thinking the Luther burger, which is a burger between donut slices, is one thing. But there's just something about this that I'm like, I don't see it.
Yeah. Let's highlight a few more of these. We got I'm surprised this one hasn't had some sort of copyright lawsuit. It's Pizza Lucy, not to be confused with Pizza Luce, completely separate. A Pizza Lucy is a sausage patty topped with pizza sauce, pepperoni, and mozzarella cheese, stuffed in homemade green mill pizza dough and topped with Italian seasonings, cheese, and crumbled pepperoni. You can find that at Green Mill, located on the east side of Cooper Street between Randall and Wright at Family Fair at Baldwin Park. How is Green Mill not facing some sort of like lawsuit from Pizza Luce on that one? Pizza Lucy? I don't know if you could pull that one off unless they reach some sort of agreement, but Pizza Lucy, I don't know. That one sounds kind of good, but more than like a half of those is probably going to be way too much. You're gonna end up with an upset stomach, but I don't know. I kind of like this one. What about you?
That's kind of the problem with some of the fair foods. They're like, I want to try it, but I'm not so interested in taking away from some of the things I'd rather be eating, and that's kind of one of those things, I think, for me.
How about this one right here? The Naughty Biscuit. The Naughty Biscuit is smoked pork belly topped with beer cheese, arugula, pickled red onions, and jalapenos served on a buttermilk biscuit. It's at RC's Barbecue, located on the north side of West Dan Patch Avenue between Lickett and Chambers Street. The Naughty Biscuit. I got to read through this. So we got a smoked pork belly topped with a beer cheese, arugula, pickled red onions, and jalapeno served on a buttermilk biscuit. Again, along what you were saying, one of those things to try a couple bites out of, but man, you're not going to be feeling too well if you finish that thing. We have a Jumbo Donut Sundae available. That is a jumbo frosted yeast-raised donut available in a variety of flavors topped with vanilla soft serve ice cream, hot fudge, and a blend of sprinkles. You can find that at Fluffy's Hand-Cut Donuts located between West Dan Patch and Carnes Avenues. And this is actually one of the new vendors as well, one of the four new vendors, I should say, at the State Fair. So I guess congratulations to them, because I know becoming a vendor at the State Fair is not an easy process, or getting any sort of a booth at the State Fair is not easy. In fact, that's why we haven't been there in a few years, is that it is not cheap to get any sort of booth at the State Fair, but they are one of the new vendors. Let's highlight one more of these right here. How about caramelized banana pudding? That features layers of homemade vanilla pudding, fresh bananas, toasted vanilla wafers, caramelized Cocoa Crispy cereal, caramel sauce, and fresh whipped cream at Blue Moon Dine-In Theater, located on the northeast corner of Carnes and Chambers Street. Relatively speaking, could that be sort of one of your healthier options? Although not exactly, once you look at the details, that healthy looking, but hey, you're at least getting your banana in there, I guess. All right, actually, I got to highlight this one, too. How about fudge and fruit? Combine some healthy living with some chocolate. Fresh strawberries and fudge brownies dipped in wine-infused dark chocolate. Oh, now that sounds good. Drizzled with wine-infused white chocolate and served on a stick. It's at the Minnesota Wine Country, located on the west side of Underwood Street between Carnes and Johnson Avenue. So you can feel a little bit better about yourself with that fruit part in there, I guess.
I feel compelled to point out that it's stylized as fudge and fruit, not like that fudge and delicious ice cream shop we were talking about on the show a couple weeks ago.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Not to be confused with the what was that? Yeah, wasn't that the business owner who put a sign up that said, we only want workers who are here to work. We don't want them to have any sort of personal time. It was just I think you were producing that day, weren't you?
Yeah, it was something like that. It was kind of, we just want people here to work. We don't want your political junk.
Yeah, we don't want your political beliefs, and we only want people who are here to work. Not exactly a good marketing campaign. But importantly to point out, it is very different from that St. Cloud area restaurant. Fudge and Fruit, I don't believe, has any affiliations with them. So there you go. At least a few of the new foods you're going to find at the State Fair this year, including four new food vendors. If you're really curious about checking these all out, I would just Google it. I don't think there's an official website you can go to. Just Google New State Fair Food, and you're probably going to find it. All right, we're going to take a break and come on back and talk about what's happening at the state legislature and a dispute that that's happening among some members of the DFL party about the public safety bill. So we're going to be talking about that and more coming up next here on the Matt McNeil Show with Brett Johnson filling in. Theme right there. Sounds like the 80s version. They made a new version of that show a few years ago. Wasn't it on CBS or something? Yeah, you don't know in there. Yeah, I don't follow along with network TV either, but I think they made a new version of Miami Vice, because God forbid we actually come up with original ideas for TV shows. But there you go. Patrick Lilia giving us the Miami Vice theme heading into segment number two. All right. So here's what I want to talk about in segment two. It's what's happening at the state legislature. So to give you a lay of the land, one of the major parts of the budget that Democrats and Republicans have to figure out is public safety. That's one of the final areas of the budget that has not been finalized yet. Now, what happened last night is that leaders of the Republicans in the state Senate, who, of course, have the majority in that chamber, and leaders of the DFL, who have control of the House of Representatives, met and came together with an agreement on public safety that does include some police reform measures, but not nearly enough, according to some of the more progressive members of the DFL party. And I can get the frustrations with some of the progressive Democrats that aren't happy about this compromise that was reached, because some of the things they wanted on there are pretty reasonable, including the idea of having police body cam footage being released within a couple of days of a police shooting. How about this for a novel idea? Not having police officers affiliated with white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups. You would think Republicans would be on board with that measure, but they're not. So I definitely get the frustrations being expressed by a number of progressive Democrats and the lack of police accountability measures that are in this agreement between the leadership of the DFL House and the Republican-controlled Senate. And I especially get that in light of some comments made by Republican State Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen. This just gives you an idea of how rigid and out of touch some of these Republicans are when it comes to police reform. If you remember, Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen is the guy who wanted to shut down state parks because Governor Tim Walz was going to implement a clean car rules. Yeah, he was going to try to shut down state parks because he wasn't happy about clean car rules. He was trying to hold up funding for Minnesota state parks because he wasn't happy about that. And that's despite the fact that Bill Ingebrigtsen, during the special session, took a special fishing trip to Alaska. I don't think you have the special Alaska theme lined up in there, Patrick, but that's an idea of who Bill Ingebrigtsen is. And Matt, I know, has highlighted him many times on the show. Republican from Alexandria. And some recent comments he made today just highlights how out of touch a lot of Republicans, especially from rural Minnesota, are. How out of touch they are with some of the concerns that a lot of people of color have with policing in Minnesota. This is a quote from Senator Bill Ingebrigtsen. He says, "I'm really tired of hearing that because you're black, you're getting pulled over. That's not even part of my thought process, and I think we should quit that because it's dividing us horribly." So he basically doesn't recognize that people of color get pulled over at a much higher rate than white people. In fact, we even have stats on this in the city of Minneapolis. This was a Star Tribune report from earlier this year that showed, and I believe the Reformer was on this too, black and East African drivers accounted for 78% of police searches that started as traffic stops for moving violations or equipment violations from June 2019 through May 2020. White drivers, in comparison, made up only 12% of searches during that same period, even though they were more likely to wind up with contraband when searched in the first place. So the white drivers that do get pulled over are actually more likely than the drivers of color who get pulled over to have contraband in their car. So again, black and East African people accounted for 78% of those traffic stops in Minneapolis between June 2019, May 2020, even though white people make up a majority of the city of Minneapolis. So that gives you an idea of where Republicans in the state Senate stand on police reform measures and why so many progressive DFL members of the legislature are frustrated with this compromise that was reached between the House and the Senate. I'm guessing from the House perspective, they're probably sitting there thinking with the leadership that we got to get some sort of bill passed. We don't want a government shutdown. So the logic is, yeah, we're not going to get everything we want with police reform with this public safety bill, so we have to kind of settle for what we can get. But understandably, a lot of members of the People of Color Caucus and Indigenous Peoples Caucus among the DFL were not happy with this compromise. So what they've done, they've taken a couple different tracks to try to counter the lack of action we've seen from Republicans in the Senate. Now, one action that they're taking is loading up the public safety bill in the current House of Representatives with all sorts of amendments that would do things like release body camera footage of police shootings within a couple of days of when said person is shot, and of course, not having police officers be affiliated with neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups. So what's going to happen is that, yeah, this public safety bill will probably end up getting passed in the House with these new amendments that were added. But then when that bill works its way over to the Senate, well, Senate Republicans are probably going to strip out all of those amendments and we'll have to try to come to yet another compromise all before tomorrow night, if you're still with me. So that's one of the tacks that progressive DFLers have been taking on police reform. But there is another tactic that they're trying to use to get some more police accountability through, and that has to do with something called the POST Board, or the Peace Officer Licensing and Standards Board. Again, POST stands for Peace Officer Licensing and Standings and Standards Board. This is basically the agency that licenses police officers around the state of Minnesota. And they're trying to encourage Walls to take some executive actions with the POST Board to implement some of the measures that likely won't make their way through the state legislature. And Walls has agreed to take some executive actions in regard to the POST Guard, or to the POST Board, rather. Walls says he's taking some executive steps on policing, including $15 million in grants for preventing violence, policy for state law enforcement to release body cam footage to families of those killed by their police within 5 days, and making the POST Board data more public. Now, what's important to note right here is that I think what Governor Walls is referring to when it comes to releasing that body camera footage, that only has to do with police officers that are run by the state of Minnesota, not your local police departments. Unfortunately, in those cases, when body camera footage is released, has to do with those local departments. So that only, I think, will apply to the state patrol, since Walls says the only way you can force local police departments to release body camera footage is through a law passed at the state legislature. And as we mentioned, fat chance of that happening given the Republican makeup of the current state Senate. Walls told reporters on Monday he did not think he could order state troopers to limit traffic stops without changing state law. So what he's talking about is trying to have state troopers not pull people over for minor infractions, whether it's maybe a busted taillight or an air freshener hanging from your rearview mirror, or having expired license tabs. Wall says he doesn't think he can do that, as it would need to be done by the state legislature. So, again, as I mentioned, some of the progressive DFLers would like Walls to take more action with the licensing board, or POST. And going around the legislature, as reported by MinnPost, does have considerable limitations, at least when it comes to the POST board, because not only is the board required to follow a lengthy rulemaking process, its members are free to ignore the wishes of the governor and lawmakers. So while Walls can make these recommendations to the POST board, they don't have to necessarily implement these measures. Now, if you're wondering who is on the POST board, well, it was originally 15 members up until 2020, when it was expanded to 17, which was a move made after the murder of George Floyd. The board is made up of various police representatives, as well as people representing the higher education system and members of the general public. Those two new board spots that were created are members of the public. In April, the POST Board did agree to seek changes to statewide standards for handling public assemblies and write a policy banning officers from adhering to white supremacist ideology or affiliating with white supremacist groups. So technically that is in with the licensing board, again, the POST Board, but I think it would be better to actually have that in state law, that you can't be a police officer and affiliated with neo-Nazi or white supremacist groups. Still unbelievable that Republicans aren't on board with that measure. So there are a number of things and actions that you can take with the POST Board, but unfortunately, the power that the POST Board has is rather limited, as I brought up, since they don't even have to follow Governor Walls' recommendations, and it's also a lengthy process. So in essence, it would be a lot quicker to do this through the state legislature, or something I've brought up on previous shows back when I did my old weekday show, is that when it comes to police reform and trying to change police accountability, you're going to have much more luck doing that at your local city and municipal level. You can already see how much of a pain it is to try to get any sort of accountability measures through the state legislature. And even with that, it's really your local jurisdiction that has more governing power with your police department. So if you're someone who does want to make a change with policing in Minnesota, you're going to have far more luck doing that with your local city or municipality instead of asking Governor Tim Walz or the state legislature to do something. Now, the state legislature and the governor do have some power. I just think most of that is going to come from your local city, town, or wherever you happen to live. So that's, I think, the big lesson to take away. I know there are going to be DFLers who are going to be pressuring walls to take more action on the post board. And some of these should be taken when it comes to licensing police officers, but you're still going to get a lot more done, at least at the local level. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Do have a few more minutes before we head to break and speak to Patrick Houlihan of the Minnesota Reformer, who is going to have a lot more news of what's happening at the state legislature as well as some other political topics. But we'll have to see what happens with this public safety bill at the legislature, as they do have that deadline of tomorrow night at midnight to get things passed. Otherwise, we are going to have a partial shutdown. And Patrick, you and I were talking about this between hours. It seems like the language of the politicians, whether Republican or Democrat, has been shifting over the past few days or weeks, where I remember even at the start of the special session, they were saying, there's no way we're going to have a government shutdown. But we're slowly starting to hear them kind of backtrack on that, saying that, well, we still have some things to work out. Or I'm trying to think of who I heard say this yesterday or a couple of days ago. They were saying, well, even if we do have a partial government shutdown, it won't impact a lot of people in the state of Minnesota. But I think you and I have both noticed that the language has changed when it comes to talking about a government shutdown, where back in early June, they were saying no chance it's going to happen whatsoever. Now they're kind of open to the possibility that we very well could have a shutdown.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because I was listening to an interview on another station earlier with Tom Hauser from KSTP, their chief political reporter. And he was talking to, I believe he said he was talking to Paul Gazelka, and Gazelka said there's a 99% chance that, you know, we'll be done. And
there's a chance.
Yeah. And Tom Hauser's just thinking to himself, I've been in this too long to know better than that, was basically the gist of his thinking when he heard Paul Gazelka say this.
Yeah, and a big reason why we're so behind in the special legislative session is that back when the session started and we were debating some of these budget bills, Republicans were throwing in endless amendments and basically doing a talking filibuster, which did delay the work of legislature members of the legislature by a few days. So that certainly didn't help, and I'm guessing the debate we're going to be having tonight of adding more amendments to the public safety bill isn't going to help things either when it comes to trying to get a bill passed on time. So, yeah, it is going to be a mad dash scramble tomorrow to get that public safety bill finalized, because it's very likely that the House bill and the Senate bill are going to look very different. Even though leaders of both parties did come to an agreement last night, it's probably going to be changed with these amendments. Because, yeah, if you're sitting there as a member of the legislature and a DFLer and you're forced to vote on an amendment that would prohibit police officers from being affiliated with white supremacists and neo-Nazi groups, I mean, how on earth do you vote no against that? That's a no-brainer right there. Or the idea of releasing body camera footage in a timely manner when there's a police shooting. That's another no-brainer. But unfortunately, these are going to be stopped in the Senate. So, yeah, I get what they're doing on the DFL-controlled House, because this probably is one of their only chances to actually get any sort of police reform passed, because as we've already seen from Republicans, they're campaigning on the issue of being tough on crime. Kind of like we're going back to the early and mid-90s, back when that was a big campaign issue. So if we're not going to get anything passed in 2021, unlikely anything is going to get done in 2022 or 2023, as the GOP will probably up their defund the police and Democrats are soft on crime arguments. The exact same playbook we saw in the 90s with Bill Clinton.
And going back to that same Hauser interview I was referencing, he said a lot of that same stuff. He said, you know, this is basically the way that the bill is written right now is a Republican victory. All of the things that they found the most objectionable from a Republican standpoint are not at the moment going to get passed. And the Democrats, at least Portman and Wallace, have basically said, you know, this, you know, we can't get any more than what we have. And that's, so as I said, it's basically a Republican victory. They didn't get any of the things that they hated the most in this bill.
And you imagine if they were debating this, let's say, in June of 2020 instead of June of 2021, the rhetoric probably would have been a lot different, where Republicans might have been on board with some of these police reform measures, or at least open to it, because if we remember how raw the emotion of what happened to George Floyd was back in June of 2020, I could see Republicans saying, hey, you know, we should be on board with some of these measures. But unfortunately, politics plays a role the more time carries on, and lo and behold, as you said, it largely is a Republican victory because, as you said, we're not going to have several of these amendments to the bill ever enacted that at least the GOP found most objectionable, and especially members of the police union. So it is kind of a catch-22 when you think about it for Democrats, because the question is, do you dig your heels in and say, you know what, we're not going to have a budget unless you at least agree to some of our police reform measures. You're getting everything you want, at least when it comes to compromising, you got to give us some stuff too. But the question would be, would you really want to hold up the state budget and a government shutdown over those measures? That's a tough political question for a lot of Democrats to answer. And I'm guessing that's probably what leadership was thinking too, is that the optics would not be good if they had a government shutdown because, well, we're having bills being held up over debates on police reform measures. That plays right into the Republican wheelhouse, I would think, of saying, look, Democrats even shut down the state because they want to defund the police. Look at how extreme they are. Granted, what I'm saying is out of context, but that is exactly the type of argument we would be hearing from Republicans.
And looking ahead to 2022, because that's a non-budget year, basically, as it was put, there's no obligation to really do anything in next year's legislative session because there's no budget to have to take care of. So I think in the aftermath of everything that's happened with George Floyd and the subsequent killings involving Dante Wright and Winston Boogie Smith and others, this was the moment, and it looks like the Republicans are going to get what they want.
It's unfortunate, and if you're someone who's been hoping for changes on police accountability, yeah, very frustrating. And as you said, this probably was our one chance because 2022, unlikely anything's going to happen, being that it's not a budgeting year. All right, we're going to take a break and talk more about what's happening in Minnesota politics with Patrick Koulikan of the Minnesota Reformer. So stay with us as we'll be talking to him up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson back with you on a Tuesday afternoon as we're joined now by Patrick Koulikan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, minnesotareformer.com, for the latest in Minnesota news and politics, as he joins us today to talk about the final few days of the legislative session, as well as some other political news in Minnesota and around the country. Patrick, thanks again for the time today.
Always good to be here, Brett.
So let's start with the state legislature, because last night we had an agreement between Republicans and Democrats, at least among leadership, on the public safety bill. That has been one of the more contentious issues at the state capitol. But unfortunately for the Democrats, there are a number of DFLers who weren't happy with the final agreement and the fact that in the public safety bill it did not contain a number of police accountability measures that some Democrats and activists have been pushing for, including the banning of pretextual traffic stops for minor traffic violations like the one that we saw with Dante Wright when he was killed by a police officer back in April. So it sounds like now that some members of the DFL on the House side are going to be loading up the public safety bill with a bunch of amendments, which will probably lead to the House bill being very different from the Senate. So overall, this is going to very much complicate things as we approach that Wednesday night deadline, I'm guessing.
Right. So they have to pass a budget by Wednesday night, get it signed by the governor. Otherwise, funding stops for public safety-related institutions like the courts, the prisons, and the state public safety agencies like the State Patrol and the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. And it is obviously a contentious issue, one of the most politically complex, and so it's not that surprising that it would be the last one that they would settle and that it would come so close to the deadline. And in fact, it's not really settled. Leadership came to this agreement. Democrats, after having a I would say, a successful session on budget issues. Did not get much on the police accountability front. And, I mean, what they did get, pretty minor, regulating no-knock warrants, some civil asset forfeiture reforms, and then a police misconduct database. But it doesn't really get the stuff that they wanted, including, as you noted, stopping pretextual stops, which is what happened to Dante right before he was killed by an officer. And as a result, these progressive lawmakers in the House DFL are going to put some amendments on to get these items in that they want. And it's going to pass. They'll pass, and then the bill will pass. So now you're going to have this bill with a bunch of police accountability measures that Senate Republicans are not going to accept. So they're going to strip those amendments. And now you're going to have two different bills. And the deadline is coming up on 24 hours away. So pretty high stakes. And we'll just have to see where it goes.
And you were talking about how Republicans are likely to strip out any of these amendments that end up getting added to the House bill on public safety. But I'm interested in what their approach has been from the DFL leadership and what they think about this idea of loading up a bunch of amendments as we are so close to the deadline. I'm kind of curious what their thoughts are on this, if you have any insight.
Well, you know, to a certain extent, it's not as if it's in their control. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a narrow majority. They know that there's this block of progressives from the Twin Cities, the People of Color and Indigenous Caucus, who this is a key priority, not just for them, but for their constituents. And we know already from this session that they can't just tell their members which way to vote. And because earlier in the session, there was the leadership and Governor Walz wanted this money for law enforcement and in advance of the trial, the Chauvin trial, that was going to reimburse local law enforcement agencies for the work they did during the trial. And the same progressive members said, we're not voting for it unless we get some assurances on some police reform issues. And so the bill died. They lost the vote on the House floor. I think that it's just not enough. You can't just tell these members how to vote. And I think leadership knows that. And I'm sure that was communicated to Senate Republicans that, you know, this may happen. I think they tried to ameliorated a little bit with Governor Walz issuing some executive orders yesterday to try to improve the situation. But again, they can't just tell their members how to vote. Those members have election certificates, as we like to say, and they get to do as they choose. And so it's kind of where we're at.
Yeah, and as you said, Governor Walz is going to issue some executive orders on police accountability that we talked about earlier on the show prior to when you were on the show here, Patrick. So, yeah, they're definitely trying to work through some of these differences. I know Walz was straight up asked by some of the activists that will he veto the public safety bill, and he gave a pretty emphatic no. So things are going to the deadline, as usual, with the state legislature, so it'll probably be a late Wednesday night as they do approach that midnight deadline. Moving on to another topic you wrote about today in your Reformer newsletter, you talked about voter ID and how more and more Democrats, at least at the national level, are coming on board with the idea of having some form of voter identification, including Stacey Abrams being among those people who are saying that they are open to now having a voter identification system in place. It's an interesting dynamic, though, that you wrote in Minnesota, being that we voted down having voter IDs being required to vote back in 2012. So it's an interesting dynamic since at the national level, Democrats seem to be more open to this issue. But in Minnesota, yeah, it is a much different dynamic being that we voted it down. I just want your take on that
Could we see any possible future action, or is there really no appetite, especially from the DFL side, being that we did have that amendment voted down back in 2012?
Yeah, I don't see it happening here. I think it would be disrespectful to the voters, and I think there's a lot of there's some DFL activists and operatives who worked hard on that issue, they don't want to see all that go to waste. I think the dynamic is quite a bit different here. I had somebody write to me say, well, notwithstanding the 2012 vote, this is a conservative kind of operative. So our polling shows that the public now, the Minnesota public, heavily favors voter ID. Mm-hmm. I told him the word notwithstanding is doing a lot of work in that sentence, because an actual vote of the people is kind of the thing that's more important than your poll. it's an interesting national dynamic. And I think what some voting activists, voting rights activists have discovered is that they don't really think that voter ID laws suppress vote as much as they feared. And so therefore it could be used as a good trading, a little piece of leverage. And I think it's important to note also that Democrats who have softened their position on it, they're often reacting to this compromise legislation that's been put forth by Joe Manchin. Mm-hmm. They really want to win on this, and they'll take Manchin's bill is a pretty good bill, so they'll take it. And I think there's just some softening based on the idea that if you can get other measures, it's worth trading up. And what I suggested also today is that we ought to have, I mean, there's some of these proposals have been written where you don't have to pay for a voter ID. You can get reimbursed, but it's still very difficult. And it can be very difficult. You have to take off work and go to go get it and all that. And there's a lot of different tasks that our society requires an ID, and a lot of people who have trouble getting an ID, and we ought to make it easy and free for people to do it. And it actually might improve people's lives. But it would have to be any voter ID. I think you would pair it with that proposal to really help people get an ID and make it easy and cheap, or free, actually. Sorry.
Yeah, and the devil is in the details when it comes to things like these. If we could provide a free ID and get people access to the required documents they need to obtain that free ID, since in some cases you might need your birth certificate if you've never had a photo ID, so there are some barriers that would need to be addressed. But as you said, there are a lot of benefits that could help out low-income people when, you generally do need a photo ID to do a lot of things in society. So there certainly are some benefits. But I like the idea that you were talking about from the Democratic perspective. If you're someone who's involved with a party, it's not a bad idea to use that as a bargaining chip when it comes to talking about voting reform, where you can offer it to Republicans and say, all right, we'll give you the voter ID if you give us X or give us Y. So it's some interesting strategy put on by Democrats, at least at the national level, but probably won't be happening locally here in Minnesota. But I thought it was a good take to bring up, being that that the Dems have certainly changed on this, and even just the past few weeks with the Joe Manchin compromise that you were alluding to.
Right. Maybe if they could just get the Republicans to agree that the candidate with the most votes wins.
Yeah.
That might be a good trade.
What a novel concept. Yeah. The candidate with the most votes wins. Yeah. If only we could go with that. A final story I want to talk about with you, at least in the Reformer today, and that has to do with a guest commentary that was written today from Sarah Lawrence, who's a retired labor lawyer, easy for me to say, and former member of the Democratic National Committee from Minnesota. And she wrote an open letter to Joe Manchin talking about why he needs to be on board for voting rights, even if that means getting rid of the filibuster. And she makes a pretty strong argument talking about how, really, if you have one political party that has completely embraced anti-democracy measures, the filibuster's not going to do you a lot of good. So good guest commentary that you had today from Sarah Lawrence talking about the need to get rid of the filibuster in that open letter to Manchin.
Yeah, she's an interesting guest writer for us as our second contribution. And I think that she she really captures it when she says, preserving our democracy should not depend on support from people who do not believe in democracy if it means they lose. And in the case of Manchin, his voting rights proposals, I mean, as she says, if they get enough support to prevent a filibuster, great. But if they're going to oppose voting rights, then she is faced with a choice between bipartisanship just for its own sake and democracy. And the choice ought to be simple, is what her argument is. And it benefits from the fact that I agree with her.
And final few questions for you here, Patrick. I know you have a new podcast coming out this week. If you guys can give us a little preview of what people can expect on Reformer Radio, which you can not only get wherever you can find podcasts, also airs on AM 950 every Sunday from 12:30 until 1 o'clock. What can people expect on this week's episode?
So I interviewed a freshman Republican lawmaker named Jordan Rasmussen, and he's an interesting character because he's only 28. And so it seems like he's the future of the party. He's not a Trumpist, he wants the party to make inroads with suburban moderates and Black and Latino voters. But on the other hand, so it's like he's represents a promising future for the party, but it also seems like if he's not going to embrace Trump, you know, does he have a home in the party? And so we were kind of exploring that in our conversation, and then Max and I, our host Max Nesterak and I, talked about it as well. So it's a good episode.
Yeah, make sure you check that out. It'll drop on Friday wherever you get your podcast apps, or you can also listen on AM 950 radio this Sunday at 12:30. And last thing for you, I know at the Minnesota Reformer, you guys do a lot of great journalistic work, and unfortunately, that work is not free to provide. So right now you are having a fundraising drive going to make sure people support the Reformer so we can keep that great journalism going. If you can talk about that for a little bit and the importance of supporting the Reformer and making sure you guys are able to keep doing what you're doing for years and years going forward.
Yeah, I appreciate it. We're a small operation, and I think by all accounts, we're kind of punching above our weight. We're doing pretty hard-hitting work on the investigative and the data side. I think our analysis and storytelling is also is good and worth paying for even. So if you get a chance, go over to our website, MinnesotaReformer.com/donate, and throw us a couple bucks. We'd appreciate it. The money goes to things like our First Amendment lawyer and travel. We sent a reporter up to the Enbridge pipeline site twice, as well as paying fair wages to some really high-quality freelance writers.
Absolutely. Website again, MinnesotaReformer.com for the latest in Minnesota news and politics. And make sure you give them a follow and also your support as well. MinnesotaReformer.com. We've been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, about some of the news of the day. And Patrick, as always, appreciate the time today.
Always good to be here.
All right, and that's just about all the time we have for our Tuesday show. A reminder, Matt McNeil is back on Thursday with a live show, while Todd Mickelson is going to be filling in tomorrow. Stay tuned. We got Native Roots Radio presents I'm Awake up next on AM 950.